Well, Stephen Hill will be concluding his series on providence tonight. And with Stephen's agreement, can I offer a few words about words? To some of us, the word providence might seem a little mystical or otherworldly. And I'd like to form a backdrop for the subject that Stephen is talking about tonight. Interestingly, as many of us know, the base word for providence is provide. The word provide is helpful in grasping the significance of providence. Pro means before or ahead, and vide means to see or to watch, hence our English word video, which means we look at the screen and see the image. So God's providence simply describes how God has already seen our need and provided for it. He knows the beginning from the end, and that foresight and foreknowledge is God's providence. He's taking care of us. He's providing for us. And that's so reassuring, isn't it? Now we have a reading, Philippians chapter 2, the first 13 verses. So with that reading, we'll hand it over to Steve for the final session in his series of three on providence.
Thank you, Jeff, and good evening, everybody. And good evening to those at home. One of the challenges with this subject is it's really a study of the whole Bible. And of course, you can't do all of that in two or three nights. So inevitably, I've been fairly selective about which verses we look at, what particular points I highlight. And Jeff said it's the result of my personal studies. That's true. But equally, it's a reflection of my life, the experiences in my life. And whilst experience alone is not a very useful guide as to what's right or wrong, coupled with our knowledge of the Bible, it's very, very significant. And that's what we're going to see tonight. So that's our subject. Just to remind you of what we have done before, the first evening was the big picture, the universe, the creation of the planet and everything on it, and God's foresight with prophecy and a few other things, the big picture, as I put it. And then last one, we looked at more focusing now on the family of God. So we're looking at the fact that we're all of more value than sparrows, as Jesus put it, and looked at some of the broader issues, including time and chance. Or if you want to, time and chance. And so we're going to now get even more focused tonight. We're going to talk about each of us individually, personally. So this is, tonight's not about what might happen somewhere or somewhere else, or perhaps more broadly the ecclesia. No, we're tonight talking about you and me personally in our lives. So our subject, God works in you. We've kind of touched on that a little bit before, but this gets rather personal. In you, God works in you. And you might think, well, okay, that's what the Bible tells me, but I'm not sure what he's doing, or I don't know how to tell what he's doing. So we'll be trying to make a bit more solid idea behind this as we go through. So firstly, we want to talk broadly about how those of us who are baptized, how we got here, how we became one of God's children. And there's some, oh, that's going to be out of order. There we go. First of all, we're told God called us. So we're not here because we thought it would be a good idea to get baptized. We're here because we heard God calling us by name, as it were, that he's saying, I'm inviting you to join my family, you personally. And those of us who've been baptized may not perhaps have quite thought about that at the time, but hopefully now you appreciate that is in fact what happened. And more specifically, James uses the expression that he brought us forth. So it's the idea of a birth, of coming out of the waters of baptism. You're moving into a new realm, which we did when we were baptized. Okay, 1 Peter 1, we're called the elect, or in other words, selected people. God's picked us out. Many of us who have been in the ecclesial membership for a long time, like myself, you do wonder things like, well, why did he pick me? What did he see? Because often we might look at ourselves and say, well, I'm not really sure there's much in me that was worthy of his attention. But that's what we're told. He did do that. And he leads us and he's with us, as Psalm 23, like a shepherd who's out in front, not like in Australia where they're way down the back. And the traditional picture is the shepherd's in front and we're following, and that's a New Testament expression quite often, isn't it? Jesus says, follow me, following. So we're not blindly wandering around, wondering where to go. He's right there in front of us, and we're just following his steps. It shouldn't therefore be something that we find our future all uncertain and I don't know what to do or how to go ahead with my life. We're following in his footsteps. In Corinthians, Paul says, everything is for you. Everything's for you, including the kingdom. So again, why do we sometimes feel very uncertain about our position? Again, in 1 Corinthians, all things are yours. And let's look at these two verses in Philippians. One we've read already, but chapter 1, verse 6. And these two verses are pretty obviously linked when we read them. So Philippians 1, verse 6, being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. So God began a work in us when we were baptized and even before that. And he's not going to say, well, I've worked hard enough on you and it's not working out too well, I'll go and find someone else. No, he's going to stick with us until the day of Jesus Christ. Now, that term, a good work in you, follows over into chapter 2, verse 13. And we'll look at this in some detail later. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to do for his good pleasure. And I won't comment on it because, as I said, we'll deal with that later. And then in Romans 8, verse 32, a really powerful verse. I'd like you to look at that if you can. Romans 8, verse 32. He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all. Now just pause here. What Paul is saying is God has given you as a gift his son. He's given it to you and you accepted that when you were baptized. So he's already given you his son. Now think about God. What greater thing could he give you? Well, nothing. The greatest thing anyone could give would be their only begotten son, even in a natural sense. God's already given us his son. So he then says, well, since he's done that, won't he also give you freely everything? Everything else, including the kingdom? Of course he will. So this is what God is doing. And in this particular verse, the point is, if he's already given us his son, the rest of it's not in doubt. He's not going to say, I've given you the greatest gift of all, but I won't give you the extra bits. Well, that doesn't make sense. He's given us the most precious thing ever that's existed, apart from God himself. And so he's saying, well, obviously, Paul's saying, you'll get the rest of it for free. You won't have to worry about it. It's already lined up for you. So I want to take this now a little bit further. We've talked a little bit about the fact that we're following our Lord in his footsteps. So let's look at some verses that talk about walking with God, similar picture in our minds. Well, first of all, Amos says two people can't walk together unless they agree. Because if you don't agree, after a while you'd separate, you'd go off in different directions because you can't get on with this person. So to walk with someone means you agree with them. You're a companion. You just work together. You're in, if you like, fellowship. You're together. That's the principle behind this notion of walking. Now, there's quite a few examples, just a few on the slide. Enoch walked with God, we're told. Noah walked with God. In Micah, we're told to walk humbly with our God. And Levi, we're told, walked with God. All of the examples of walking with God because they're in agreement with God. In the New Testament, we have a word which is interesting. It means to walk in line or in step or in order. In other words, we're not just walking any old way we like and sort of vaguely trying to keep up with our Lord. No, we're walking in step with him, in line, in order. We want to be as close to following his footsteps as possible. That's the notion of the New Testament word. It's kind of linked to the idea of being in agreement. So there's a harmony here. Romans 4 says we need to walk in the steps of Abraham's faith. Philippians 3, walk in the same rule. Let us be of the same mind. There's this agreement again. Romans 8, a couple of times in the early part of the chapter, talks about walking according to the Spirit, which might seem a bit vague to us because we've never really grappled with the word Spirit very well in our community. We get a bit twitchy when people talk about being possessed by the Spirit. And we know there are groups who talk like that quite a lot. And therefore, perhaps we've just tended to or just ignore the subject and we won't get a problem. But if you've got Romans still open, in my Bible it's the page before in verse 1, there is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Now we can work out fairly easily what it means to walk according to the flesh. I think you'd quickly realise that's talking about the way we think and the way we behave. It's of the flesh. So he's not talking about, some miraculous gift of God here. He's talking about two ways of thinking, two modes of thinking and living. It's either according to the flesh or according to the Spirit. And like so many things in the Bible, there isn't a half and half. You haven't got one foot in each, although sometimes we might think we are. In God's sight, it's one or the other. And we'll explore this idea of the Spirit in a moment. Galatians 5 actually says a lot more about it if you want to look at that later. Picks up the same idea of the flesh and the Spirit. In fact, Paul there says they're in conflict. There's a warfare between these two. It's worth having a closer look at Galatians 5 sometime yourself. So what do we make of this concept of the Spirit? Well, I'm not going to get into a complicated exposition. I'm just going to quote you from two brethren, which I think are really helpful. The first one is, in fact, not just an individual. It's what some of you may know is called the Christadelphian Magazine Publishing Association. In other words, it's a committee that looks after that magazine published in England, which I hope more of you would read than perhaps do, because you can get it online every month for a reasonable cost. Way back in 1983, I say that for the benefit of those who are a lot younger than me, doesn't feel so far back to me, but it is a long way back, isn't it? This is, to me, one of the most enlightening and simple explanations of this idea. The activity of the Spirit is God at work. And in the New Testament, it is almost always God at work in Christ for the salvation of men and women who believe. So if the term Spirit sort of gets you a bit unclear what's going on here, just put in that place, this is God at work. And that the one word to explain God at work is the word Spirit. So it's not mysterious. It's simply saying when there's a Spirit happening, it's God working in all kinds of ways. The Word, the Bible itself, makes abundantly clear that God is at work on behalf of his sons and daughters in a variety of ways. Christ himself actively superintends the ecclesia. We say ecclesia's there because we're in different places around the world, but in fact it's one ecclesia. We talked a bit more about that last class, so we won't elaborate on that. It is neither necessary nor scriptural to seek to define all the ways in which the Lord provides his help. So don't get hung up on the idea of, I have to figure out exactly what God did in my life at this point in time, because you can't. So don't sweat that. It's simply accepting that God's working in your life 24/7. You may not feel it or notice it as much as perhaps you ought. And don't try to analyze it too much. If you live with a sense in your mind, as much as possible, every day if possible, God's working in my life somehow, that's really, really valuable, especially in difficult times. Brother Alfred Norris said something quite similar. We do not seek to understand, still less to explain, the manner in which God employs his Spirit for the benefit of his children. So that, I think, is helpful. Now, can you come with me to Ephesians chapter 3 and look at verse 20. Another one of these God working verses. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. So firstly, those words piled on one on top of the other, aren't they? Exceedingly, abundantly, above. Three times he's saying it's way, way beyond what you can even begin to understand, that God's power is working in you. Two words there we want to explore, power and work. Okay, let's just go to the first one. The word power in the Greek is dynamis or dunamis. You can recognize that word in English. Dynamic is an obvious connection. Dynamite is another one. And they carry this idea of power, something powerful. And it's got force behind it. Let's look at some examples very quickly. We'll just look at a couple in Ephesians since you've got that open. Romans 1:16 says the gospel is the power of God to salvation. Chapter 15, abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. The message of the cross is the power of God. Our faith in the power of God. The excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. So we might, in some form or another, express some power. We can move things, we can influence people, whatever. He's saying here, well, that's God doing that, not you. And that the day anybody thinks, oh, I'm doing pretty well here, I'm influential, I'm important, they've lost the plot totally. It's of God, not of us. And Paul, of anybody on this planet, living or dead, could say, well, it is of me, look at me, I'm the greatest apostle. No, not at all. 2 Corinthians 12, that's Christ speaking to Paul, my strength, power, same word, my strength is made perfect in Paul's or in ours weaknesses. So where does this power show itself most? In the weak. It doesn't show up in people who think they're already powerful. They're not suitable for God's work. It's people who are weak, who feel they're weak. That's where you can see in yourself and maybe in others, wow, look how God's power worked in that person's life. They're insignificant, humble, not noticeable, but they've done some wonderful things, and it's God's power doing that. Now, Ephesians, let's go back to chapter 1. Verse 19, I know it's on the slide, but it's worth just imprinting the words in your brain one way or the other. Paul is offering a prayer here, and he says, what is the exceeding greatness? Again, see this double emphasis? Exceeding greatness of his power toward us who believe according to the working of his mighty power. Well, both words are in there. But we'll come to the work one in a minute. But he adds another two, mighty power, as two other different words. I'm not going to explain them, just pointing out which words are the dynamis is the first one, the word power. And we'll see the next slide we get to look at work. That's the one underlined. And then there's these two other words. So Paul's really laying it on. Not just saying simply, well, God works in you, full stop. He's piling on these words, picking four different words to say, whoa, this is what God's doing to you. He's doing this in your life every day, whether you notice it or not. Chapter 3, verse 16, he picks up one of those extra words here as well. Again, this is a prayer. That he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with might through his spirit in the inner man. And one more, 3 verse 20. And we've already read it. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. Now, whatever you think about this topic, and they're not every verse in the New Testament where this word's used, you cannot avoid the strength of all of those verses and the emphasis on God works in your life. And it's not just once or twice in your 70 or 80 if you're lucky. It's all of us, all of the time. That really does take a lot of thought, doesn't it? To really absorb that concept. It's always been in our Bibles, but I suggest we haven't really focused enough on this, hence I'm labouring the point somewhat. Now, the other word that we looked at in Ephesians 3, verse 20, is this power working in us. Now, it's the Greek word energio. Now you know what that's like in English. It's energy. energetic, whatever word you like. It's easily transformed into the English word. And it's pretty much what it does mean. So let's do the same thing. Let's just look at a quick list of how this word is used. 1 Corinthians 12, the same God who works in all people, that is. Later in the same chapter, the same Spirit works all these things. God's at work. That's the Spirit. Ephesians 1:19, which we've already read and looked at. Here it's the word working that highlighted. The exceeding greatness of his power toward us who believe according to the working of his mighty power. 3 verse 20 we've also looked at already. To him is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think according to the power that works in us. So it's not just power going whoosh and maybe some of us respond. That's not what God's like. When God moves, then things happen. It's a force that can't be resisted. Just a quick aside, the word spirit in the Old Testament, some of you can remember, it's the word ruach. But how it's pronounced, well, not so much pronounced, how it's to be spoken is like this, ruach. It's a forceful word. In fact, one person who's an expert on Hebrew says it's the sound of a great horse snorting for battle. Boom, out of his nostrils, you know, on a cold day you can see all the condensation, the force. That's this word in the Old Testament, and the New Testament picks up the same idea. It's powerful. It achieves what it wants to do. It's not going to return to God void, empty. Now, Philippians 1, we've already looked at. He has begun a good work. It's a slightly different word. In fact, ergon is the root word from which energio is derived. They're connected words. He's begun a good work in us, and he will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. Philippians 2:13 we're going to focus on a little while, very soon. In fact, it's the next two slides after this one. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to do. The word do is Jeff's version that he read correctly, translates that as work. It's the same word, just used twice in the sentence. So let's say it this way. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. So it's all about God's pleasure. It's not about ours. So he's working in us. And one more, in Thessalonians, the word of God, which also effectively works in you who believe. So even the words of the Bible are having the same effect as the Spirit of God having an effect on us. Right, let's get into Philippians. It's a few years now since I realised what these words were about, and I'll share that with you. Philippians 2, verse 12 is, well, sort of straightforward. And unfortunately, depending on how your Bible's punctuated, verses 12 and 13 are one sentence. They're not. There's no break between the two verses in language. And that's the problem. We need the verse numbers because otherwise we wouldn't be able to find anything. So they're a fantastic, useful thing to have verse numbers. But watch out that you're not cutting off a half a sentence by looking at one verse. You would do that here if you only looked at verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And if we stop there, it gives the impression that somehow our salvation is about us, our work. We've got to achieve it somehow. And it's a pretty scary exercise because we're going to be in fear and trembling. And there's a good example, very good example of the mistake of stopping there, because the very next verse, the rest of the sentence, goes on to say, "For it is God who works in you." So this is not our work, it's God's work. "In you both to will," that is to give you the desire, "and to do," to work, "for his good pleasure." So we need to sort of tease this out a bit. First of all, the word "work" is our familiar word, the word energio, but it's in what's called the present active voice. Don't get too worried about Greek grammar. It's far more complicated than English, which I hate, and I hated it in school. But I've learnt there are some good things I should have learnt better back then. But I've tried to get my head around a bit of Greek grammar. Present active means it's constantly happening. It's in the present, but then next second, that's the present, and another second, that's the present. It's just going on and on and on. So working out our salvation is a lifetime. That's the point here. And there's a couple of people who are far more expert than I, like Barclay. He says it's to carry to its perfect conclusion the work of your own salvation. So it's sticking it out to the end. It's what chapter 1 said, that what God's work is doing is going to continue until the day of Christ. It's not just something that happens occasionally. It's all the time. Okay, but what about this expression, fear and trembling? Well, Barclay's got a beautiful way to explain that. It's not the fear and trembling which drives us to hide from God, like Adam and Eve did. Rather, the fear and trembling which drives us to seek God in the certainty that without his help, we cannot effectively face life. So we're not afraid of God. We're afraid of letting him down. That's all. It's not something that should cause us to become frozen. It's something to say, well, I need God even more. And he goes on to say that pretty much. When we really love a person, we're not afraid of what they may do to us. We're afraid of what we may do to them, how we might disappoint somebody that we love, how we might not live up to what is a reasonable expectation from the one we love, that we might hurt the one we love. And many of us, particularly if you're married, I guess, you can feel that sense of wanting to do absolutely the best for the love of your life, but you're well aware that you don't quite make it. And so in that sense, there's this fear and trembling. We don't want to disappoint the one we love, and we don't want to disappoint God, do we? But when it says work out your own salvation, this is not salvation by works. Ephesians 2 says that twice and says it really emphatically. It's not about achieving your own salvation by your efforts. For example, in John 15, there's a lot of talk about the vine. But notice in that section in John, the vine, everything is Christ. So the roots, the branches, the fruit, everything is Christ. We are in there just as the conduit for his power working in us to bring forth fruit to his glory. We're no more than a branch. And you know, he goes on to say, Jesus, in that chapter, and once the vine's useless, those branches are just cut off and thrown in a fire. That's how little value as a human being we have. We have value in a spiritual realm, not in a natural realm, because we know how inadequate we are there. Our fruit, or our works, if you like, are God's works in us. We're simply responding to his love, clearly expressed in the giving of his Son. Okay, now let's move into verse 13. God who works in you both to will and do for his good pleasure. Now, the word to will is to desire, as one person defines it, or a couple of people, or in many other translations, it's actually the word work, as I've said and as Jeff read. So there's using this word twice in this sentence. Barclay says of that verse, it is God who, that he may carry out his own good pleasure, brings to effect in you, in each of us, both the initial willing and the effective action. So when you decided to get baptized, you might have seen that at the time, and you may still, as your choice, your considered decision. What Paul is saying, God prompted you to do that. Now, you could have said, don't want it, don't, not interested, and you can walk away. But God is giving you that inclination, often from reading the Bible or from listening to a talk or from however you've felt that need to get baptized. Paul is saying God created that need in you. You weren't sitting in some isolated island in a little cabin on your own just thinking and saying, I think I should get baptized. We're all part of a community, a family here and many other places around the world. And one way or another, God is trying to influence us. And those who are not baptized, they're the ones who, as those from one who is, they're the ones we're trying to see if that force, that influence from God can create in you a desire to be baptized. And when that does happen, we're all incredibly excited. And we know, because Jesus said, the angels in heaven rejoice when that happens, because you've responded to this influence that God has put in your life. Brother Tom Barling has this way of putting it. The energy they display really comes from God. And Brother Bedwell puts it this way. Both the will to do these works and the power to achieve them are alike attributed to God working in believers. Hebrews 13 has a very similar verse. We won't turn it up. It says there, he's praying that God will make you complete in every good work to do his will, working in you what is well-pleasing in his sight through Jesus Christ. You remember that comment from the committee that it's most often in the New Testament, it's not just God directly influencing us, it's through Christ. He's now carrying all of those roles that in the Old Testament was reserved for God himself. All of that's been delegated to Jesus Christ. He's the one doing it now. Okay, I want to talk a bit about prayer. Because that's where we're connecting with this God who's trying to change our minds and change our behaviour. And so prayer comes into this because it's about how we talk to God, not just about what we ask for, how we communicate. Now, there's a well-known verse, I think it's well-known, in Romans 8, we do not know what to pray for as we ought. And perhaps you felt that quite often. I don't know. I certainly do. Don't know what to pray for. I'll start to elaborate on examples in a minute. So rather than asking God to make our lives easier, which often is what our prayers boil down to, we should ask him to give us the strength to face whatever that difficulty is. If you think about it, if we believe God's working in us and we're confronting a very difficult situation, God knew that. He may have even put it there. We don't know. But he's not saying, oh, oh gee, I see you've got a problem there. Oh, I'm sorry about that. No, no, it's all totally under his control. Now, it may be that if you ask it to go away, it will, that depending on God's will, but it may not. And then is what you need to ask for is the strength to cope with that. And we'll explore that a minute too. So simply tell God your needs, not the solutions. We have no idea what the proper solution to any things in our lives it would be. We might have a personal feeling about what we'd like to happen, and I guess you can tell that to God, but it's far more important to say, look, this is the problem. I don't know whether you're going to remove it because I'm talking to you about it, or whether you're going to help me deal with it, but whichever it is, focus on what you need, what you perceive you need, and then let him work out the solution. Our friend Dr. James Dobson has some good words on this. God will not perform on cue to impress us. We serve this Lord not because he dances to our tune, but because we trust his preeminence in our lives. Ultimately, he must be and will be the determiner of what is in our best interest. We can't see the future. We perceive only the small picture, and not even that very clearly. Given this limitation, it seems incredibly arrogant to tell God what to do, rather than making our needs known and then yielding to his divine purposes. Now, when we do pray, particularly if we're asking for something, we know that there are three possible answers. There's yes, there's no, and there's a, well, perhaps in due time, maybe some years away, I might do that. Now, we don't hear those words back, of course, to our prayers, but they broadly are the three options. When I first thought about this many years ago now, I had this real sense of, that makes my prayer life so much easier. I'm going to show you a list, not a complete list, but a list of where God says, if you ask for this, you've got it. No ifs and buts, you have got it. And another list saying, if you ask for this, forget it, you're not going to get it. And another list of where, depending on God's will, you may or may not get it. There are, I can show you, we'll be showing you, those three lists. And it's been a huge help to me. Hopefully it is to you. So when the answer is yes, now just keep this point in mind. The following list are statements, clear statements of God saying, this is my will. So you'll see at the bottom of this slide when I get to it, it's kind of not appropriate to say, if it's your will, God, because he's already told us it is. There's no if about it. Okay. There are no conditions to this other than our faith. God loves to bless. Lots of references to that. He will heal the brokenhearted. He will heal the brokenhearted. Not maybe, will. He will guide us. He will give us wisdom. He will give us strength. We've actually seen that in Ephesians tonight already. He will give us peace. He will give us mercy and grace to help in time of need. Not next year, now, in time of need. It is therefore inappropriate to qualify such requests with, if it's your will. He's told us that it is his will. I'll give you a personal example. You may have heard me say this before, but I think it's appropriate to say it again. You are generally, most of you are very well aware that 30 years ago, just over 30 years ago, our daughter was killed in a traffic accident. Now, we didn't know that immediately. There was a roughly an hour, something like that, from when the accident occurred to when she died. And the family were all down at Flinders Hospital waiting to hear what would happen. About halfway through our waiting time, one of the doctors came in and said, "It's looking pretty bad, just to, you know, so you're not expecting it all to be rosy in 5 minutes." I don't know where it came from, except that I know Philippians 2:13 tells me where it came from. I prayed for two things. That she would live, of course. What else do you want to ask for? But I also said, and the strength to cope whatever happens. And the answers were pretty clear within a few minutes. No, you're not going to have her alive. Yes, you're going to have the strength to cope. And the evidence for that on reflection had already started before she was even hit in the accident. I could quickly look back in the last few months and say, wow, that's incredible. That was happening without me knowing what was around the corner. And then within minutes in the waiting room of the emergency area, it's a different layout than it is now, there was a volunteer who came over and talked to me. I'll take too long to explain all that. But it was brilliant advice. And it kept going, that sort of thing. So the answers were clearly no, because that's one of the God-willing situations. And the answer was no. But the request for wisdom and strength and so on, they were given. They were starting to be very obvious straight away and have continued ever since. I mean, you can tell it's still an emotional issue. Any parent would know what I feel like. But it does happen. And believing that it happens is a big part of being able to see that it happens. How else are you going to interpret what goes on unless you know God's working? So quickly, when the answer's no, well, it can be because our attitude's wrong. Here's some examples. Unresolved conflict, insincere and vain repetitions, being unforgiving, being self-righteous, like the Pharisee, unlike the tax gatherer, faithless. So clearly there are situations where, no, you know, if you've got that sort of attitude, you're wasting your time, really. And here's one that's very interesting. Peter says about husbands who don't care for their wives, your prayers will be hindered. So in other words, God's not going to listen to that prayer if you husband are not treating your wife properly. And that applies to me. I'm a husband. And any husband here knows that's a big call, that. Well, and then there's other things where the request is inappropriate. Now, we don't get told what they might be, but we have some examples. Paul's thorn in the flesh, which we've already touched on. No, it's not going to go away. Sorry, Paul, you need to have it. The disciples wanting to build three tabernacles at the Transfiguration. No, it's not appropriate. I want to sit at the Lord's right hand or left hand in the kingdom. No, it's not for you to ask for that. Command fire to come down and destroy some people. No, that's inappropriate. So they just give us some idea of the kind of things God will definitely not give us. But then there's the third category, God willing. And we've got some examples of this. Hannah asked for a son, and she hadn't been able to have one. So whether we have children or not is one of these areas where we don't know whether God will provide us with children or not. Jesus in Gethsemane, we know that situation. Whether he would go ahead and be crucified, he said to God, essentially, I don't want to do this, but if it's your will, I'll go ahead and do it. And he knew it was God's will, but it was not something he looked forward to physically. Whether someone will live or die, as I've already explained in my life. In Acts 12, we've got Peter and James in prison. One is executed, the other set free. Why not both executed or both set free? That's where God's will is shown as one example. And in Daniel 3, that's the case of the friends of Daniel in the fiery furnace. Paul's travel plans. A couple of times he says, well, this is what I'd like to do, but we'll have to wait and see if that's God's will for me. And James even says about our own travel plans. We might think, oh, tomorrow I'm going to go into this city or that place, whatever. And James is saying, well, hang on, you don't know. If God's will that you do, fine. But he might not let you go. And don't get upset because he's got it all planned out. And generally, in John's first letter, he talks about our requests being subject to the will of God. But on the other side, we know from Peter that God is not willing that anybody should perish. He hasn't planned to wipe out most of humanity as something like he would love to get rid of people. He doesn't want anyone to perish, but sadly, because people don't want him, they will perish. But he would prefer it otherwise. And Brother Melva Purkis, in his really interesting book on prayer, which you may not be aware of, you may be aware of his book on the life of Jesus, but his book on prayer is excellent. It may be years before, looking back, we're able to recognise his gracious answer. It is through this submission to the wisdom of God that we walk joyfully along the path he chooses for us, learning in the process that he will answer our prayers according to his will. I've got two more slides. Can you put up with a bit more? Because this is really the crowning point of the three classes, so sorry if it's going on a bit. God's sovereignty is what I want to focus on and finish on. That just means God's the king, the all-powerful. He's totally in control. He's absolutely perfect, right, always. He's absolutely number one. He's the sovereign. He's absolutely top of the heap, so to speak. And that's what Romans 9 is all about. A lot of Romans 9 is about. We won't turn the verses up, just we're running out of time. From verses 7 to 13, he talks about Isaac and Jacob were chosen, but Ishmael and Esau weren't. And if you're Ishmael or Esau, you might feel a bit hard done by it. So having explained that, he rhetorically says, well, somebody might say, after reading that, is there unrighteousness with God? Or as we might say, is God unfair? How can it be fair that God just seems to almost arbitrarily say, well, I like Isaac and Jacob, but no, I don't want Ishmael and Esau? We might think, well, that's not fair. Surely they should all be given the same equal chance, a fair go, whatever expressions we might use. It's a fairly natural question. And you might have asked that question about your life. Is this fair? Well, that's a big subject, but let's just look at how Paul develops this. First of all, God is the standard of what is righteous. He is intrinsically righteous. Okay, so the risk here is that we're starting to say, well, I've got a better definition than you, God, because I think this is righteous and I don't think that is. So what have you got to say about that, God? Well, what Paul is saying is, hey, hang on a minute. You're talking to the one who is righteous. Be very, very careful. from verses 15 to 18, Paul goes on and says, well, God shows mercy and compassion on whom he wills, and he chose not to show it to Pharaoh. Like it or not, that's how it is. And so, the rhetorical question comes in, well, if that's the case, why tell Pharaoh off? Why punish him? He's only doing your will, God. You see that natural question that anyone could ask. It seems reasonable to question God. Verse 20, Paul says, okay, that's enough. Do not talk back to God. Who are you talking to? Think about who you're talking to. You're talking to God and thinking you know better? No, just back off, back off. Now, you might like that response. You might say, well, I still want to know more about why. No, God's saying, back off. I'm the sovereign here. I am doing my will for your pleasure ultimately. Just back off. He's not accountable to us. And there's a classic example of this in the Bible, an excellent example. All the way through Job, just by the way, he was saying to God, look, God, I'm in real trouble here. All my children are dead. All my possessions are gone. My wife thinks I'm stupid. I'm sitting here covered in sores, sitting on a pile of broken pottery. What's going on here? I want you, God, to come here, stand in front of me, and you explain what you're doing. That's exactly what Job said in my terminology, but it's there in his book. And it went on for chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter. And then God finally says, okay, I'm going to talk. Now you listen. And it appears that he didn't answer Job's question. But he did. And after Job absorbed what God is saying, Job said, I'm sorry I ever opened my mouth. So that's a very good example of not talking back to God. It's actually on the next slide, but put it in there. It's quite okay to question God in a respectful way. But if it's in a challenging, I know better than you attitude, that's not. One writer says, most of our problems arise and seem insoluble because our image of God is distorted. We've tried to make God be like us, to reason and think and behave like we do. And because he doesn't, we just struggle with that. Well, forget what you think. What is God telling us? And that's what we've been trying to get across in these three classes. And Paul responds to all of this in the rest of the chapter on making three points. God is the potter. He has got control over the clay, and he's got every right to make that pot whatever shape he likes. And he makes them for different purposes. They're not all the same. We must let God be God. We are on holy ground when we are discussing this, when we are praying. We have to let him do what he does and not question it. And as I've said, Job admitted he had gone too far by criticizing God. And then the second point of his response is, well, God is revealing himself as he is, and everything he does is consistent with his character. If you don't see it that way, then your comprehension, as we quoted before, of God is wrong. And until you stop trying to reason humanly and make God something that you prefer, you've got to stop that and say, listen to God. Tell me, God, what are you all about? And it's a lifelong job, and there's a big Bible to read. It's all in here, but just takes a bit of humility and teachableness to get it all in our heads. And we're told that he shows patience with those whom he eventually destroys. For example, Pharaoh. He didn't destroy him straight away. He could have. More importantly, to those shown mercy, he will make known his glory. So that's his work, that's his choice. And thirdly, all of this was foretold in the Old Testament, and he quotes from Hosea and Isaiah, and some remarkable quotations they are, because it says Israel will be a remnant. But hang on, wasn't Abraham told he'd have a seed as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sand on the seashore? Yeah, but they're not all Jews. And that's the point Paul's making here. There's only a remnant of Israel that are part of God's plan, because most of them don't want to listen to God like most of the world today. And in particular, they couldn't accept that Jesus was their Messiah. They stumbled over that. And that's where Paul twice in this section says, and God's purpose is now with the Gentiles as well. And we're there. We're in his picture here in Romans 9. All of this is to include us in this purpose of God. There will be a multitude without number in the kingdom, but it's from every nation and tongue and language and people, tribes, every part of the world is included in this wonderful kingdom. Thank you.